sit down, boys. Have I got a treat for you?
Fighting the fight when it comes to technology. We are the knights of the kingdom of geekery. We rise up when it comes to the challenge of discussing all this nerd knowledge. We are the digital soup. We are the digital soup. We bring information with lots of laughter. Tune in now if that's what you're after. Digital Soup. We are the Digital Soup. We are the Digital Soup. With Jason, Adam, and usually Dave.
All right, guys, welcome back to Digital Soup, the only podcast that agrees with Meatloaf that 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Well, I'm usually Dave. Joining me in the virtual studio today, as always, I've got Adam here with me. And again, Jason is away this week. Hey, Adam. Jason tells us he's away this week, and he said it's because he pulled a hamstring leaping out of his Lazy Boy during the Vikings-Lions game. He actually got to watch a Vikings game for a change, which is pretty funny.
Pulled a hammy. Yeah. Pulled it right off.
Well, pulled it right off. The funny thing is, well, it's not funny. Jason's writing, he can't be on the show, but he's writing show notes and adding some stories for us, and he's writing these intros for us, and it always feels incredibly weird reading someone else's words.
He's here in spirit.
Yes, in spirit. If only we could do a Crackers the Clown impression.
I'm not even close.
No, I'm not.
You have to get the volume so it wrecks the microphone.
Right, full distortion. No, I'm not even going to try it. My voice is shot right now, this stupid cold. But Jason, before we get into kind of what we've had going on, he did have a note here to tease once again that we will be announcing the Patreon subscriber monthly giveaway next week. So definitely, if it's something, we have no idea what he's planning. I mean, no clue.
You might be sorry if you win, but hopefully not.
Right. But whatever he's planning on doing as far as some sort of monthly giveaway, if you want in on that, you need to head over to patreon.com/digitalsouppodcast, I think it is. And go to our website, digitalsouppodcast.com. You'll see the Patreon button there. And if you want to get in on the giveaway, you can certainly support the show there with a few different levels. So apparently Jason's got a contest giveaway coming up, and he will be, at least as of right now, he's scheduled to be here next week.
All right.
For a super review with our awesome listener Vincent, who we're going to be reviewing the oh so terrible Masters of the Universe movie, but we'll get to that next week. So Adam,
can't wait.
Yeah, right. What's been going on for you this week? I mean, all of us have been busy, so not a lot of chatter going on.
Well, my funnest story I kind of told you offline already, which is I'm trying to get into astrophotography, folks.
Yeah.
That means I want to get out there and take pictures of the night sky, try to get some star shots, Milky Way if I can. And there's this great hill that's out at this kind of park near my house. And so I drove out there a couple nights ago, and I've never actually been to it before, but I can see from the road that you can, from the highway, that you can hike up this thing and go to the top. I'm like, oh, it's all flat. That should be great. Well, it's flat like to get out there. It's not like it's super thick or anything like that, but I go out there probably only like 9 o'clock PM, which, I mean, it's dark here already at that point. And I get my camera gear on and I start walking up, and I've got a headlamp on so I can, you know, be hands-free and still see.
Yeah.
It's going fine. No big deal. There's a wide trail out there. It's mostly like field and some trees and stuff like that. I can't really see too well. It turns out the base of the hill is farther than I thought. And so as I'm walking towards it, I'm kind of going, huh, have there been cougar sightings out here? So I start psyching myself out immediately. I start kind of, my head becomes a swivel. I start looking around, you know, well, shouldn't be anything. By the time I get close enough to the base of the hill, what I thought was like a reflective sign marker turns out was a set of eyes. And then there was another set of eyes next to it that appeared, and just kind of reflecting back at my headlamp through the dark from probably 30 yards away.
That's the worst feeling.
I immediately turned around and started walking away. Nope. This is not worth it. It's probably deer or something, but I decided to go to a different spot that was not out in the middle of nowhere, and I could hear the coyotes just howling after I left there. So I'm guessing it actually was coyotes. But
so you avoided Mr. Wiley.
Yeah. Yep. Good I didn't thing. Want to be the roadrunner.
No, it's funny. When you were telling me that story, I could hear in your voice, I'm like, uh-oh, what's going on? He doesn't usually call me later in the evening, you know?
Yeah, I called Dave. Like,
It's usually me pestering Adam later at night because I'm out cruising around listening to podcasts or something and feel like chatting. But I get this call, and I can hear in your voice, you're kind of like, yeah, like not out of breath, but kind of like worked up a little. I'm like, hey, what's up, man? And you're telling me this, and there is nothing creepier than, like, yeah, you've got a flashlight, essentially, you know, a headlamp on. But that's still a lot of darkness all around you, you know, and it's creepy knowing there's eyes and something potentially following you, stalking you. Your mind just goes to that place like, what, I'm going to get eaten here any second.
Yep.
But I love the fact you went back out, found a different spot and still made some shots. And you sent me just one of them. And it's a great shot, man.
Oh, thanks. So, yeah, that was kind of my story. It's of what I did.
So you were
I ran out of the forest wildlife. Scared.
Yeah, I spent a lot
it was
of
probably
time
two
in the
kittens
woods.
Or something stupid.
Well, who knows? I mean, thing is, you're better safe than sorry because you never know. And I mean, yeah, if it was deer or something, fine, whatever. But you know, had you not turned around, imagine walking up and they start coming towards you, and you find, you know, you saw two of them and there was four more on the sides you didn't see, and you got a pack of coyotes around you. And
it's the velociraptor theory.
Yeah, exactly. And they do hunt in packs. So, I hate that feeling. I've been there a time or two in the past myself. And
well, no, it is have not you ever fun. Told your story on the show about the wolves?
Well, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, it's a hunting story. Yeah, I can tell you that. It's kind of similar to what Adam did.
That's the reason. Yeah, the reason I called Dave, listeners, is that he had a worse experience than what I just had.
Well,
I think it's worthy of sharing because it was awesome.
Yeah, so I mean, I spend... Story. Yeah, I spend a ton of time in the woods. I grew up hunting and stuff. And so this was, I forget how many years ago now, quite a few years back now. And was sitting out hunting one evening during deer season here in November. And where I was sitting, it's this area where there's like these real dense, thick, heavy pine trees that, you know, branches all the way to the ground, basically. So it's one of those places where, you know, when there's still an hour of daylight left in the open areas, it's pitch black in there already. And I was set up in a tree at the edge of this pine stretch. And then, you know, I had to go through it to get back to my car out on the trail. And I'm sitting there and heard wolves howling, but they sounded a long ways away, you know, a mile or so. And so I blew on my deer call and I was hearing stuff move near me. And I thought, oh, I got deer coming in. So I'm getting ready. And I can't see. It's right behind my tree, but I can't see back there. It's a little blind spot. And all of a sudden, that wolf lets out a howl. And here, I called in wolves, basically, with my deer call, which is not cool. Bad enough, and I'm up in a tree. But he was so close. No. And he was so close that when he finished his howl and then he had that, you know, quick uptake of breath back in, I could hear the like, as he finished his howl, like a dog, you know, barking, and then they're kind of like, you know, that breathe in. And I was like, holy
crap.
Now,
you were up in the stand at the time, right?
Yeah, I'm up in the stand at this point, and I'm like, crap. Oh, 18 feet. So, I mean, plenty high for that.
It was an immediate threat.
Right. But here's what I was faced with, because I hear that one and I hear another one. I'm like, okay. So there's a couple wolves here and they're moving around kind of between me and my car, which is probably, I don't know, quarter mile to a half mile away from where I'm sitting at in this particular location. And I thought, it's light out here. Do I get down now? It might still be a little bit light in those pines. Do I get down now and chance it that they'll just, you know, scare them off? Or at least have a chance when it's still light out, I can kind of see what's going on. Or do I wait until it's pitch dark here and hopefully they'll have moved on and I can come out of here? So I decided, screw this. I'm going when there might be some daylight. So yeah. I climb down and I come out of that tree and I'm so glad no one was there because I'm sure they would have been laughing. I look like a SWAT member. I've got my rifle in my shoulder, finger hovering over the trigger and the safety. And I've got under the forearm of my rifle, I've got my big old mag light strapped there with a flashlight on. Because in these pines, I find there is no daylight left. It is pitch black. It's terrible. As I take off down the trail towards my car, it's pitch black and I can hear these wolves circling around me. And they're kind of tightening their circle, getting closer and closer. I'm spinning the flashlight as I'm walking. It's like I'm sweeping, you know, looking for enemies. You know, like I said, a SWAT guy.
Yeah.
And I'm catching just glimpses, you know, a little tail here, or this and that there. But, I mean, they had closed in within probably 15 to 18 feet of me. They were close. And there was a handful of them. And so they were basically making a drive. Because as we got closer to the road where my car was, a few of them in front of me broke off. And they went out and across the road, which is heavy pines over there as well. And they left just one or two. So
thinking that you're
going to
cross.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were driving me across and going to ambush me on the other side of the road. Well, I got my keys out before I even got to the road, unlocked the car, jumped in, rifle loaded everything else, and they let loose in the ditch on the other side. The other two came bolting across the road, and they were snarling and howling, and they were mad because I, you know, they didn't get to eat me, but that so was...
Did they circle your car?
No, they stayed in the woods, and I got glimpses of them there, and I didn't even bother opening the window.
They were making a ruckus then?
Oh, yeah. They were. You could hear them with the window shut even, because I didn't even... Oh. I was shook up, like I was kind of shaking and stuff, and I got in the car, shut the door, and locked it, as if they could unlock a door, you know, open a door.
He walks up and puts his paw under the handle. Get out.
Yeah, and so I was shaking, nervous, scared. I was like, oh, my God, just breathing heavy, and I could hear them just... Oh, it was bad.
Listeners, so I knew this story already. And that's when I saw the eyes, I immediately thought of Dave. And I went, not tonight. Because yep. I didn't have a rifle. I had a bunch of camera gear.
My deer rifle, it's a bolt action, and it holds 4 shells. So had they come, I would have got one shot off and hopefully made it count. Mm. And would have had to eject real fast, and at best, I could have got 3 more shots off without having to try and reload in the pitch dark with wolves coming at me. Oof. But the important part is, much like you did,
yeah,
you didn't give up. You went back out in the woods. I'm still in the woods all the time, always hunting out there, bud. And you got some good pictures from it, so
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's crazy. No, the only thing I really did this week, I spent a lot of time out in the woods this weekend, of course, getting set for deer season here, speaking of that, but... The biggest highlight for me, at least as far as good stuff that was going on, there's a lot of stuff I won't get into here family wise, but, we had a Pinterest win tonight for dinner as we're recording this. And, you know, every now and then it's nice to kind of just, you know, try out recipes you find on Pinterest that look good. And we had one that, oh man, it was phenomenal.
Sure.
It was a Tuscan chicken.
Ooh,
in a kind of like a garlic sun-dried tomato cream sauce of some sort with Italian herbs and stuff in it. So you cook the chicken in there, get a little sear on that, then let it finish cooking as you make the sauce in the same pan, and then just put the whole thing because it makes a little bit of sauce, not real heavy sauce, or not a lot of sauce, but it's all over just like egg noodles. And the recipe didn't make a ton of sauce, and we were kind of bummed at first, mm-hmm. like, well, there's not really anything here, because you're thinking like Alfredo when it's really, you know, saucy all over. But this sauce, because of the cream and the sun-dried tomatoes and everything else, and it's a very rich sauce, so you only need a little bit to kind of basically toss in the noodles and just lightly coat everything, but oh, man, it was so good. I mean, I ate, it's like three and a half hours ago already. I ate dinner and I ate too much, and I am still just like stuffed right now. It was so good though. So Pinterest for the win, sun-dried Tuscan chicken.
Nice.
Is pretty good.
One last thought on our whole outdoors thing. I will go back, but I want to use the buddy system.
Yeah.
Because if I'm hauling camera gear.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
So next time you come
and
down
that's
here.
That's the weird thing too. Like I'll go out. Well, yeah. Well, you know, and that's what's funny because I go in the woods like this weekend. I was in the woods with my dad. I mean, we're getting stuff ready for deer season, putting stands up, all that kind of stuff. And I don't go in the woods by myself without a gun. Mm-hmm. When him and I go in the woods together, he's carrying a pistol. I don't have a gun.
Right.
because there's two of us and he's got a gun, and so I'm fine with that. I like comfort level, yep. Easy.
And the thing is, for me, it's the fact that I don't have eyes in the back of my head, but yep. with two people, yep. you do. You know.
Yeah.
So if it really got into it, you know, those things that are going to attack you are going to be looking for. They're not going to attack right. you on the front. You know.
No. Well, there's a downside to this though. And it makes me think of a story with Jason, actually. Years and years ago, Jason and I and a few other friends, we were out camping at you know where McCarthy Beach State Park is?
Not off the top of my head. But.
Up by Inside Lake here near in northern Minnesota. But
okay.
we were camping there. And this is a campsite that's, I ask about that because it's not like roughing it camping. Yes, you're intense, mm-hmm. but I mean, it's like a
it's state really
park campsite. Yeah, I mean, it's very clean and there's no wildlife, much squirrels, and that's about it. But we're all sitting around a fire that night and we were hearing stuff in the woods and we were all like legitimately getting scared, freaked out, thought maybe it was skunks or, you know, something sure. like that. And we got freaked out enough where we all, boom, pretty much all left the fire and went into our tents and we're kind of peeking out only to find it was a stupid, big, fat toad. That was hopping around and there was a bunch of us there. I don't know what we were scared about. Nothing grown was going to come men. By us. We were, yep. yeah, it was a couple guys, a couple girls and grown adults, no beverages. Cause in a state park, it's illegal to drink booze there. So we were just hanging out around a fire, having pop and, you know, whatever, just visiting, hanging out. And we're hearing this noise. It freaked us all out so bad that until we saw it was a big toad, and that was the buddy system backfiring because we all kind of kept feeding into each other's fears. So, but yep. we'll go out that's in the true. Woods shooting. I'm not afraid of that.
Yeah, it sounds good.
Long as they don't have to use drones to find us after.
No, exactly. So this story, just a stone's throw away from where I live, and just about an hour north here, there was a missing child, and so this kid, was he six? I think he was 6 years old. He was missing for about 10 hours and he had run off to play with his dog, I guess. And the dog, must have run off or something. And he ended up getting lost. It was getting cold out, you know, it's getting into the 40s and 50s and, you know, it doesn't seem like it's that cold. I guess for Minnesotans, that doesn't seem super cold, but for a 6 year old or and right. anybody that's exposed to that temperature for a long period of time without a jacket, it's bad. Mm-hmm. And so they got together about 600 volunteers and multiple law enforcement agencies to try to find this kid. And what ultimately happened was a local man who has a drone showed up to the command center and said, "Hey, how can I help? Do you have a grid I can search?" And he had basically FLIR like level infrared heat vision for his right. FLIR camera or for his drone. So over a cornfield, he spotted the boy lying on the ground with the dog. Like, I don't know if they're, he was holding onto the dog to stay warm, but I mean, that's a good boy. Good boy, dog.
Right. right.
And stayed so he identified him and they were able to send people in to go get him. He was like 3/4 of a mile off the road or something like that, I right. guess. And well, but this is a great story about a drone that somebody using technology to save somebody's good. Life.
Yeah. Right. Well, and that's a thing, you know, when a lot of people I heard, you know, up here talking about this and like, yeah, it's a kid and stuff, but he's in a field. How did he get lost? You know, but the thing is, you get out in them cornfields. I used to bow hunt out near Fargo.
I mean, they're tall.
Yeah.
You can't see anything.
When I was younger, we used to bow hunt out. I have an uncle that lives out near Fargo and we'd go out there and you get walking in those cornfields, even during the daytime, but especially as it gets, you know, towards dark and after dark, you don't know what direction you're going. You can't see anything. There's no landmarks. Everything just looks the same. It's like yep. trying to navigate when you're out in the middle of, you know, a huge lake where you can't really see shore in any direction. You right. don't know where you're at.
And there's a reason they have a corn maze around Halloween time. You
right.
can't find your way out of this stuff. It an average corn plant.
I thought the reason
plant,
was to scare kids.
Well, that too. But an average corn plant is 8 feet tall, folks. They're not. It's not like a little right. short thing that you can see out of. If you've watched The Tall Grass on Netflix, which is weird, it's kind of that similar concept where you are in a maze because all these rows of corn, the way they're
the
planted.
The Tall Grass?
Yep, The Tall Grass. It's basically an offshoot of a Stephen King show or a Stephen King book.
Okay.
And so it's just like a horror film? Yep, it's a horror film. And it was kind of horrifying and also kind of weird. But
I
didn't care much.
I thought initially of Children of the Corn.
Oh, that, you know, too.
Old classic, but yeah.
Yeah.
That's the new, progressive insurance commercials. They all come out of the corn.
Yeah, I saw that.
It's just like, wait, that's the way to stay calm and talk to the customer with respect. Way to keep them calm. And he's panicking, running to his house, you know. And the one guy's like, did you guys hear weird voices when you're in the corn? And they're like, no. And he's hearing the echoes.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Sometimes.
But they ended up
scary stuff.
So when people search these things, they line up. That's why they needed 600 people. You walk in a line formation doing your search and rescue. It's fantastic. The kid was found unharmed. You know, he was chilly. Mm-hmm. His dog kept him protected and safe. Love a happy ending. So absolutely. The Tall Grass is. Have you ever heard of it?
No. That's why I was asking
more about the story. But it is a Canadian supernatural horror film, and it is based on a book by Stephen King. Stephen King and Joe Hill's novella called In the Tall Grass.
Isn't that that's so basically his kid, right?
Is it Joe Hill?
I think so, but I think he goes under a different name, but maybe I'm wrong on that, but.
Oh yeah. His name is Joseph Hillstrom King. Must've been. I didn't know that, but, the gist of it is this, and this isn't in our show notes or anything, but, this popped up and I'm like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. What's this all about? This couple ends up stopping by, or it's not a couple, it's a brother and sister. They end up stopping on the side of the road and they hear some kid out in this tall grass screaming for help. They go in and it just turns into a complete nightmare. There is all kinds of wackiness going on in this place and time loops and, you know, some weird big stone that's like above a precipice to hell. It's like, it's crazy. Weird. I had no idea what I was getting into when I watched it. I'm like, oh, it was not my kind of movie, but I watched.
What is the name of? Yeah, I need to check that out. What is the name of his series he's got going? I can't think of it. I watched the first season. It's on Hulu, I think. Stephen King. Oh my gosh! But it ties in all of his folklore.
Yeah,
but there's when you said time loop
episode.
What is the name of that? I'm drawing a blank. But anyways, when you said time looping, it made me think of that because there's some weird stuff that happens in that show as well, especially towards the end of the season.
Castle Rock,
that's what it is. Yeah, some weird kind of time loopy, but not only time, but like dimensional jumping. I don't know what's going on. It's super bizarre, but it's a really good show.
Okay, yeah, and I've only watched the first episode. I'd have to actually rewatch it at this point.
Okay.
Did you see It 2 yet?
No. I wanted to go see it in the theaters, but we got real busy with some stuff and the stuff going on with my grandpa and everything, and it's just I wasn't able to get out. I wanted to see It 2. I wanted to see Rambo. Didn't get to see any of those. I did to go see, what was the one I just saw, though? Oh, Joker.
What about Rambo versus It?
Ooh. I think
you want a
I think
war.
Rambo wins because he already is the worst nightmare.
Oh, that's true. That is true.
Technicalities.
So get your collapse operating system ready, as you may need it sooner than you think, as we talked about last time.
Right.
Apparently there's an asteroid called 481394 2006 SF6 and it is set for its closest approach to Earth November 21st. And of course the REM song we're referring to is It's the End of the World as We Know It. So this 650 meter celestial chunk is classified as an Apollo asteroid, the most dangerous class of asteroid. Danger, danger, danger. Crikey, look at this asteroid. Having an Earth-crossing
orbit. Now I'm picturing someone there like taunting it. It's going to bite.
You have to grab it and hold on to it.
Yeah,
So it's going to pass, it's going to hurtle towards the Earth, or it's hurtling towards the Earth at 18,000 miles per hour. Now, what is the actual distance it will pass from? Because a lot of times people get really frightened about this stuff because they think, oh, man, it's really going to cut it close or else it's going to impact somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm kind of wondering is what's the actual distance from the Earth that this will pass?
Yeah, I'm looking at it, and as we mentioned earlier, Jason put stories in for us to talk about. That was kind of him, but neither one of
very
us,
kind.
You know, did anything to look at the show notes much ahead of time. Yeah, I'm not seeing a thing, but they're saying because of something called the Yarkovsky effect, which is when the soft force of sunlight can steer asteroids into Earth-crossing orbits and drastically alter the layout of their paths across the solar system. Apparently, it could be nudged much closer because of that effect. It says it's a 650-meter celestial chunk classified as an Apollo asteroid. I mean, it's going to be in orbit, but yeah, it doesn't really say in this article, which we've got from Jason linked up from express.co.uk.
I'm going to check a different site real quick just because some if people that are trying to be alarmist won't put in the distance because it's probably not that close.
You know, it's not saying how far. It goes on to talk about this scale. It's the Torino scale.
November 21st, 2019, it is going to be, this is according to asteroidsnear.com, from what I'm seeing here, 2,682,867 miles away.
Okay.
So not exactly super close. How far is the moon away?
Does that site you were looking at give a scale rating from 0 to 10?
Scale rating?
Yeah. And I ask, because the article that we have linked up here, it's got something they call a Torino scale, which it's a tool for categorizing potential Earth impact events, according to the article here. Integer scale ranging from 0 to 10 with associated color coding. The scale captures the likelihood and consequences of a potential impact event. A 10 on the scale means collision is certain, and a 0, of course, means it's, you know, nothing. Or a 1 on the scale, they say, corresponds to a routine discovery in which a pass near the Earth is predicted, poses no unusual level of danger. But this article doesn't say what...
Yeah, none of these articles are saying what distance they anticipate it, which they, NASA, their JPL has they've got a small body database where about this stuff, and they post this stuff, but there's so much data in it. Let's see. So it's estimated closest approach to Earth. I still think, based on what I just saw, there is 600 and it's over 2 million miles away.
Right. Well, and the thing that I found interesting out of this, because I did not realize this, that Yarkovsky effect, if that's what it was called, I didn't realize that the basically sunbeams, sun rays, you know, the energy from the sun is, even though it says there it's even soft, but I didn't realize that just that energy is enough to push something closer to, you know, basically push something away from the sun.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, when you think about it.
I've heard that too.
Yeah. When you think about the delicate balance that happens with like the Earth's orbit and all of that and how it keeps this relative distance from the sun and everything else.
Yep,
we've got to be just right at that point. So what's weird about it, though, is that with the sun having this energy pushing away, right? That means it's probably keeping the Earth pushed away from the sun and probably helping to eliminate the Earth basically being pulled into the sun via some kind of gravitational pull. So it's obviously enough to offset that. The kind of weird
thought in my
head.
It's hard to say, though, because, I mean, the moon, whether or not like the orbiting bodies around the sun are affected by the same thing, or if it's completely negated because we're in its orbit already through
that
gravity.
Could be.
Versus that's, like the, plus we have an atmosphere that absorbs a lot of the energy.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
Well, and that's what I was wondering. Cause like if it, let's just say hypothetically the sunbeam energy that is, you know, possibly going to alter this asteroid also has pushed the Earth just this far away that we are right now and keeps us there. Because it's space, once an object is moving in a direction, unless there's some force applied to it in the opposite direction, it should keep moving, meaning we would just keep drifting further and further away. So it has to be just one of those delicate, the, you know, the amazingness of space where we're right in that super finite, delicate point in that orbit where the energy pushing away is counteracted by the gravitational pull in the orbit and just keeping us in this perfect cycle. It's wild.
Well, yeah, we'd have to research how exactly that science works, because on top of all that stuff, our entire solar system is also traveling and mm-hmm. and orbiting throughout the galaxy. I mean, there's so right. many forces and things.
So, next week we'll have a special guest on, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he's going to explain this to us.
Well, that's a good question, though. Is the Yarkovsky effect also, does that impact Earth at all?
Right.
Because it pushes asteroids around with sunlight based on what we're reading here. So
right. Which, granted, much different size range. They're referring to it as a soft push for something that's about 650 meters in yeah. size compared to the Earth, you know, or even the moon at however many, you know, I don't know how many meters that would be measured at, million, I'm yep. sure. But
so just for scale, you know, mm-hmm. if people are wondering how close is this asteroid going to come to hitting us? 2.6 million miles. For scale, the moon is 238,900 miles from Earth. Yeah. That means this is going to be over 10 times the distance that the yeah. Earth is from the moon when it passes so closest to Earth.
It might look basically like a shooting star to most people.
I don't know.
Well, it probably won't be flaming.
If you can see it. Yeah, it's not hitting the atmosphere and igniting, but right. If you can catch it, because the sunlight's going to be bouncing off it maybe at the right mm-hmm. times, it should look kind of cool. Hmm. And I don't know if there's any trail that comes off of asteroids like you see with comets, but
I don't know.
But still, it is scary that we're just all floating on this, you know, throughout space, and we have no control over these things
right. that
could impact us and have impacted us in the past.
Yeah, these are the kind of stories that, like, low-key terrify me.
Yeah, low-key. He's behind it.
No, not low-key. Low-key. Like, I don't think about it often. I'm not walking around every day going, is this the day an asteroid hits us? But then you start reading stories like this, and the more you look at it, you're like, holy crap, there's stuff floating around and flying at our planet all the yep. time.
Well, and there used to be people concerned that, you know, is this going to have any kind of effect on Earth, you know, mm-hmm. at this distance? Is there...
Yeah.
You know, what happens if a comet passes between the Earth and the moon at this distance? And I remember hearing one scientist mm-hmm. from NASA kind of explain, it's kind of like, let's say you threw a snowball near a van.
Yeah.
There's not enough gravity, you know, you know, if you threw a pebble next to across a mountain, there's not enough gravity or anything right. for it to do it. You're not going to see any effect.
Right.
You know, but it's still, I mean, one of these days, pow, well, and right in the kissa.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, because, you know, science is telling us it's happened before with the dinosaurs, you know, and whether you believe, you know, I don't want to get into a religious or philosophical debate, but, I mean, you never know, like, when yeah. stuff could happen, and then, you know, we're all going to be scrambling to find our old Sega Genesis so we can put our Collapse OS to use.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hope it doesn't get hit by the asteroid. I keep mine in the basement.
That's a good idea. Got to keep those old chip sets. Did it say anything about how much the Yarkovsky effect can actually influence?
It didn't. Something? No, it just said it was a soft push energy. So I'm guessing for them to call it soft, I, in my mind, totally non-scientific research analysis, think of it as a gentle caress as if from butterflies' wings that just kind of nudge it.
Did you just describe a lotion?
No. <Let's... laughs> I just described an Earth-ending asteroid.
Ah. Let's see. Would you believe that the sunlight has the ability to change the course of asteroids and comets? Consider the asteroid 1999 RQ36. On May 19th, 2012, at the Asteroids, Comets, and Meteors 2012 meeting in Japan, an astronomer, Stephen Chesley, presented the most accurate determination of the asteroid's orbit to date. The accuracy, akin to knowing the distance between New York and LA within 2 inches, reveals the delicate nudge of the Yarkovsky effect, which is the minuscule push imparted on the asteroid by nothing more than sunlight.
Minuscule.
Yep, let's see here.
You know what I heard there, what you said? The gentle caress of a yep. butterfly's wings.
It's like a gentle breeze.
Okay.
I want to know how much just, it actually moved.
I was so glad
it,
you didn't say a gentle breeze on a summer's eve.
Okay, so the 68 million ton, one-third mile wide asteroid is being pushed around by a force equal to, as Stephen Chesley put it, the weight of 3 grapes on Earth. That's wow. just half an ounce. So, but over
That's
time.
That's all it took.
Yeah, I guess, but it doesn't say how far it pushed it.
Huh. That's, again, space, amazing.
I mean, eventually, like, if it's constant, it's going to be pushed continually. Well, sure. Every time that it gets close to the sun, it's going to be hit
right
with this stuff.
Slightly thrown off. I mean, think about it. If every day,
a scientist.
Yeah, I mean, well, you work at home now, but every day, let's say on your commute to work, when you still had a commute, if someone threw three grapes at you every day in the same spot,
that's a lot of grapes.
I mean, eventually, it's going to alter your path.
Oh, here it is. Asteroid RQ36 is one of several for which the effect has actually been observed. After 12 years of observations, RQ36 has wandered by about 160 kilometers from where it should be. That's after 12 years, 160 miles. I mean, so that's, there's no time limit. You think about, you know, a human life and how long we live, you know, up to 100 and 120 years tops.
Right.
You know, and an astral body, if something that size can be moved 160 kilometers in 12 years, you know, that's going to be 17 kilometers a year. What does that add up to? 17 times 120.
Adds up to about my 40-second sprint time.
Well, you've got something that's moving 2,000 kilometers in orbit over the course of one person's life.
Yeah.
You know, and what would it take for something to be affected like that and eventually hit Earth, that of the bodies that we just know about?
Right.
What I'm worried about are those long distance ones that we haven't even spotted yet because we've only mapped. Got to get out there and look on your telescope at infinity, see if you can find it.
The ones that come out of nowhere like a haymaker, you know.
When exactly. You're looking the other sucker way punched by an asteroid. Pow. Oh, man. Yep. So, do you want to get your picture on the Joker stairs?
Yeah.
I might get robbed.
Yeah, I was going to say, we went from kind of depressing Earth-ending asteroid talk. Let's cheer up a little bit, and then we're going to talk about people getting mugged on the Joker stairs.
So people got mugged on these?
Well, I don't know if anyone has just yet, but what's happening is there's this iconic shot that's in the movie poster for Joker, and he's kind of dancing down these stairs, and he actually travels up and down these stairs a couple times in the film. But everyone now, people figured out where it was and everything else, so a lot of Instagrammers are going there, and people are apparently flocking to this staircase. It's pretty famous in New York City, I guess. But from everything, it sounds like a lot of New Yorkers are saying, hey, you probably don't want to do this because this is a pretty shady neighborhood, essentially. You know, they're saying people are going there and, you know, it's very common for people to get mugged and robbed and murdered and everything else in that area of New York. So
wonderful.
Yeah, it's like one of those things. Oh, we saw it in the movie. Let's go there. And no research done to, you know, find out like, oh, is this even safe? You just assume, oh, a movie shot there, so it must be fine. But yeah, apparently,
you know, it's funny.
Go ahead.
The article that we're looking at, you know, there's a few people that have taken pictures on the stairs.
Yeah.
But one of the ones that they have, there's a gal in the skirt there. That's not even the same steps, is it?
It might be.
I don't think it is.
Unless it's because
handrails.
Well, and not only that, but the fire escapes on the buildings are completely
different.
Plus, it
looks like there's
hope. Yeah. Although, you know what? She could be up towards the top of those stairs. Because when you look, those fire escapes and stuff are about halfway up, and that staircase in the movie is long. And so she could be up just at the top flight or two where it's closer to the sky.
Oh, I suppose there's a couple of lampposts there that do look the same.
Yeah. And so it could be the same ones, just much higher up without the fire escapes. But just people, don't be dumb.
Not friendly there, I guess.
Yeah. Don't be dumb. Do a little research first. Don't get yourself hurt. It's like
similar stairs.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a stupid Instagram and YouTube mentalities where, hey, look at this. It's the hot springs in Yellowstone or whatever, the geysers, you know. Let me go walk out there.
Gosh, that guy.
You know, and then they trash this, but then they end up getting burnt to a crisp. Or let's go sit
in these hot... I want to be famous on the internet.
Yeah. Let's do, you know, how many... It was just last year, I think, we lost like 3 people in one trip or something because they all went and were sitting in this natural hot spring place and got swept over a waterfall.
Acid. Yeah, oh, really?
Good Lord. Something crazy like, you know, like that.
Reminds me of the YouTuber that wanted to make a famous video. So she shot a Desert Eagle into his chest because he had a book in front of it, thinking it would stop the bullet.
Right. Yeah. He convinced his wife to shoot him, and she went to jail.
Dumb.
Yeah. Here's your sign,
Darwin.
Yeah. So be safe.
Award winner. Yeah.
I think your suggestion was the best. You want to recreate this photo? Just find a set of stairs that look cool and make it your own.
Yeah, exactly. You can still do your own thing. You can use your Instagram filters, folks, on your smartphone and upload it and get it just perfect.
Yeah. Be like Quentin Tarantino. Do your own thing. Don't fall into the sheep mindset.
Yeah.
We're excellent on our segs this week.
Oh, completely excellent. So yeah, Quentin Tarantino, he's not going to recut Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for China.
Good for him.
So what's the story behind this? I know the story about Bruce Lee's daughter being upset with his portrayal.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I hated the portrayal too, just on what I saw.
But, yeah, I haven't seen the film. I heard the film is fantastic. They do portray it, you know, Bruce Lee, in this article that Jason has linked up here from cinemablend.com. Part of the problem, especially with Bruce Lee's daughter, she says the film portrays Bruce Lee as an arrogant egomaniac who talks crap about Muhammad Ali and can't win in a series of fights against Brad Pitt's Cliff Booth. Now, we know that Bruce Lee was a total bad, you know, whatever. I'm not going to swear.
MF.
Yeah, bad MF. But we have to remember, Tarantino is known for doing this, rewriting history. I mean, think about the Inglourious Basterds movie when he rewrites history and has Hitler getting murdered in a theater, right?
Yep.
He's telling a story. It's a work of fiction. But apparently, China's censors are pretty upset about it too because of how it paints their culture or something like that. And he's going in and saying, no, I'm not going to recut and completely change my movie just so that you're not upset.
No, the Chinese government trying to push a filmmaker in the United States to do something is kind of wild. Why in the what? I can understand Bruce Lee's daughter having beef on this because that's her father, and his legacy is, she is the caretaker of his legacy. I follow the Bruce Lee's Twitter page and it's pretty amazing what she's done.
Yeah.
And of course it's a big slap in the face for her to have this portrayal, you know, which, yes, we know it's fictional, and there's two camps, you know, people's, you know, the same kind of thing you just talked about. Look, he's rewriting this stuff, and it's not, we all know that's not the real Bruce Lee.
Right, right.
But also, well, you know, it's her dad, and I get it. So,
yeah, no, and I get her complaint, but to me, it's like it's someone's work of art, and I give kudos to him. I mean, not just because of China or, you know, whoever it was, just in general, on principle, where you create something you're proud of and is amazing as a story, is what it is. And then you get one person or one group of people that doesn't like it, so they demand you change it all. Instead of just saying, you know what, we're just not going to go see it. It's not for me. And no, I, like you said, with her being the family and the estate, I get that gripe a little bit. And in this article they talk about, they said basically so far, China has not actually clarified its rationale for blocking the film from distribution. Mm-hmm. Some sources are saying that Bruce Lee's daughter went to the National Film Administration in China and personally requested that they demand he change it.
I doubt it.
I don't know if that happened. Other sources are saying China's censors object to the violence in the film, which portrays the Manson murders. And I have a hard time believing that, too.
There's a few other films you might want to work on then.
Yeah, again, much like the Joker conversation we had. Let's look at John Wick, you know? But the thing is, it's not the first time this has happened to Tarantino. And in fact, I guess, according to this article, he got similar flack over his movie Django Unchained. And he did go in and edit that some at the last minute so they could release over there. And it sounds like this is just a case where he said, you know what, I did it once for you, I'm not doing it again. So kudos for him. You know, stick to your guns, stick to your art, and, you know, realize not everyone is going to like what you make. And if you don't like someone's art, just don't watch it. Don't look at it. Don't read it. You know, it's simple as that. Yeah, don't look at my art. My art's,
you know what I didn't hate?
Private. What?
Heat. So, Dave and I have watched 1995's Heat.
Mm-hmm.
Starring, of course, the iconic Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. Mm-hmm. But this actually had a lot more stars. I walked into this not knowing much about it. I think our Patreon guy Jeff had suggested this and for a super review. So yeah, we definitely checked this out. When I first started playing it and realized that it was as long as it is, which is almost a 3-hour movie, I went, oh my gosh, what am I getting myself into?
I didn't realize that until I was an hour in. And I'm watching it because I watched it in the evening, and I'm like, oh, I've been watching this about an hour. Got to be getting close to, you know, three quarters of the way through. I figured it was an hour and a half, 2-hour movie, and I paused it, went to get a drink of water, and I'm like, wait, what? An hour and 50-some minutes left? Wait, no, that's not right. Oh, a 3-hour movie.
And now we're gonna try to condense down to about 15, 20 minutes of just talking about it.
Yep, I think that'll be no problem.
Director Michael Mann, uh-huh. Writer Michael Mann, and the list of stars, their names started popping up on the screen. I was going, wow. So it's Al Pacino, it's Robert De Niro, then it's Val Kilmer, John Voight, Tom Sizemore. I didn't recognize a few of the names like Diane Venora, Amy Brennerman, but Ashley
Amy
Judd.
Amy Brennerman, I recognize.
I haven't seen Ashley Judd in a while. What's Brennerman in?
She was in a lot of TV work, I think, like cop shows. I want to say like a NYPD Blue type thing. She did some movies as well, but a lot of TV series. She was on Veep actually, for a bit.
And, so pretty popular. So,
yeah,
and I saw Natalie Portman pop up in there, and I'm like, oh, she must have been a kid in this one. Yep, she was.
Yep, she was.
And then there's some faces of people that Danny Trejo's in here, and of course he's always the guy with his name is Trejo.
Yep. Yeah.
Wes Studi, he's the he plays a lot of Native American roles.
Yeah. Yep.
And he did an awesome job in this
detective.
One. But yeah, this movie.
Who is the other detective here? I'm just looking. Ted Levine.
Yeah, Ted Levine.
He was one of the other policemen, investigators, famous for his role as the captain in Monk. The TV show Monk with what's his name? I totally lost his name now. I almost said the show Monk with Adrian Monk.
Jimmy you know Monk. The show Monk.
Yeah. There was some big names in this. You know, Hank Azaria makes an appearance.
Yep.
Henry Rollins.
Yeah.
You know that I picked him out. Tone Loc is in there.
Yep.
Actually plays a
it's
character.
Had it all. And,
yeah, it says his character's name is Richard Tarina as Tone Loc. So he played himself.
But
this
I really, really enjoyed. As far as just the whole thing was just great from start to finish to me. I think the story, as far as you know, you've got your set of it's yin and yang here.
Yeah.
You've got your robbers, your crooks that are doing all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really, I don't think they planned on murdering those guys at the beginning when they're doing their first heist, and they got this crazy wild card guy in there.
Yeah,
he just kind of messes
his name?
Everything
Will
up because that
something I forget.
I didn't recognize William
Will Grote or something like that.
In the movie, his name wasn't Will; it was something else.
Hmm.
I don't remember his name in the movie, but. Kind of a loose cannon.
Yeah.
But this kind of starts the cops coming after these guys and this crew.
Right.
And just a wild ride from there. And this, you know, the shootout part, which we had talked about before, we'd heard was iconic. It really was iconic.
Yeah.
This shootout was crazy. And I've never seen Val Kilmer do like a tactical fast reload of an AR or a rifle before. It's like, what, Val Kilmer's doing this?
His character was, cracked out weird.
Yeah.
He wasn't really cracked out, but like they did some weird prosthetic to his elbow at one point. And there's some
they
scenes
did?
At, yeah. When, remember when he wakes up on De Niro's floor, on Neil's floor?
Oh,
he's
yeah,
all
yeah.
hung over, and they show him with just a t-shirt on. His elbow is all like a big bulge of it, unless he really has that. Maybe he's got some kind of weird elbow thing, but like the way his hair was, but also that what they did something with his eyes. So they always look like he was kind of glazed over.
Yeah.
Very weird. Yeah. Just a weird thing. But that shootout, when that goes sideways, man, that was, I mean, the fact that anyone got away from that was nuts.
That was nuts. And Well, I want to come back to that.
Yeah.
But a few other things with that. I like the way, you know, first of all, now you've got me looking at every shot like as a photographer going, oh, man, this is a beautiful shot. Nice, smooth, wide angle, beautiful views, very moody, atmospheric shots, and the music and stuff was just right on point. Of course, this is a classic 1995 movie. It was
right. And there was, if you notice, it was kind of weird in the respect that, if I'm not mistaken, there was music playing under every scene.
Like there, I didn't there notice.
Was no, there was no notice. Break because I noticed some scene where it really stood out to me is when De Niro has Amy Brenneman, that the his love interest, up on his balcony after just meeting her a few hours before, and they're having romantic talk. There's music playing through that whole conversation. And it's not like it was just a quick scene.
We're going to have romantic talk.
Yeah, no, that's Pacino. Yeah, that's
you De Niro's want romantic talk?
Like, yeah, we're going to have a romantic talk, you know.
I don't want to be lonely. You want to be lonely? I don't want to be lonely.
Let's talk about those two characters, though.
Oh, that was going to be my point right before we get into it. Just, they really concentrated on the relationships between the men and the women across this whole platform. It added a lot of dynamic to it, a lot of good character depth. But anyway, let's go into that.
Well, this whole movie being a heist movie, it really is all a big character study when you look at it. You know, the way that Pacino and De Niro, they almost admire each other's tenacity. There's respect. But the weird thing is that when this movie opens, it's not really clear right away who's the good guy and who's the bad guy.
Nope, not at all.
You know, because Pacino's character as the cop, he's all slick and he's, you know, driving the fast car, dressed all in black, and he's, you know, doing his thing, and he ends up being the cop, you know, and smart. And he's just got this respect for De Niro and his crew, like, man, these guys are good. They're good, you know, and it was such a fascinating dynamic. But I don't know if this is true, but I heard a rumor, and I don't know if we can verify this while I'm telling you this, but apparently those two, during the filming of this movie, they both have massive egos, as you can imagine, and they did not like each other at all.
Really?
So apparently the rumor I heard is that they never actually appeared on set, on screen together. Even though they have their iconic monologue or dialogue in that diner, and at the end of the film, when you think about the shots,
it's easily back and
could
forth.
Have been back and forth. It could have been, you know, you see a back of a head or something. Boy, but it's all out of focus. Could
I'm not sure I believe it. And their chemistry doubles. Was there. It was pretty good.
It was, but think about that. What I noticed in that scene, now, like I said, it's a rumor. I don't know if it's true, but De Niro in that conversation, I mean, he gets pulled over and Pacino's like,
invites him to coffee.
Yeah. Let's go out and have a coffee.
Cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you about
that's my best De Niro.
Yeah, and they have a real kind of honest heart to heart. It's a pretty fantastic dialogue about why they both do what they do. They're so similar, just on different sides of the law, you know. And they're going to do what they're going to do. They know the other one's going to make a play to try and stop them, and all the cards are out on the table. They're going to make their play in best man win kind of situation, and. Yep. But in that conversation, when you think back at De Niro, he very rarely actually makes eye contact with Pacino's character. He's always looking around off to the side, looking around the room, doesn't look at him very much. Whereas Pacino is like staring daggers through him a lot of the time. Yeah. And then he kind of looks away and I don't know. Yep. It was
neither of them could break the other one. So flick fact.
Dropping some flick facts.
And this kind of negates or goes against, you know, the whole idea that they never were in the same scene, which would be kind of the coffee shop scene sold Robert De Niro on the idea of making the film. He, Al Pacino, and Michael Mann later admitted that they couldn't wait to shoot that one scene.
Okay. Yeah. And like I said, I had just heard this as a rumor, so may or may not be any truth to it. So
that'd be crazy, though.
Yeah.
Let's get back to that gunfight, because that's what everybody really wants to hear us talk about. Another fun flick fact on this one is that rather than dubbing in the gunshots during the shootout, director Michael Mann had microphones placed carefully around the set so the audio could be captured live. And it says this added to the impact of the scene because it sounded like no other gunfight shown on screen.
Well, yeah, because you can hear the echoes through the buildings.
Yeah, it was crazy.
And the changes when they're inside versus outside or near cars and, you know, all of that. That was wild. And, you know, what sets it all up, and, you know, obviously spoilers, but it's a film that's 20 plus years old now, so relax. Yeah. But De Niro's crew is going after this bank heist, and Pacino busts them. And so he gets wind of it, and they change their plans. And what they should have done, and De Niro gives his crew the opportunity to say, look, the smart thing to do right now is to walk away.
Yep.
Because he's got that famous saying, he says it a couple times during the film, you know, a man once told me that you got to be ready to drop everything when the heat comes around the corner. You got to be willing to drop everything and disappear in 30 seconds, you know, and are you willing to do that? Well, all of these guys found themselves with girlfriends, with wives, with families, and none of them were willing to walk away, and it cost all of them.
That's very true.
You know,
and De Niro's character was the only one that did at the end.
He did. And I think
high and dry.
He did. And that was, man, heartless. But at the same time, had he not messed with her at all, he would have been on that plane.
Yep.
He would have been gone. And so the woman, his unwillingness or his willingness to want to find that someone to kind of quote unquote retire with once he's out of the game cost him, because it was the delay in him going to get her and all of that stuff that happened with her as she was upset, understandably so, that he was this guy that had done this.
Yeah, she just figured it out. He walks into the
right
into the hotel and walks out, and there's a freaking apocalypse happening.
Right. Well, and even
you can
before
see it,
that,
just dawn like, on her face, like what he's. What
well, he and not only of? That, but remember before that, when the shootout happens in the street, everyone goes underground. They get Val Kilmer to the doctor, and then he goes to her, and is like, "Come on, we're got to go now. The plan's changing." She's like, "That was you," all because she's been watching the news, and she goes, "Oh my God, that's you. You were doing this," and so she's very upset, rightfully so, but. Yeah, and had he not messed around trying to go get her, he would have had everything lined up to leave. He'd have been gone, and it led to his death. Yep. What an iconic ending there too, huh?
Yeah. Well, and another fun flick fact.
Dropping some flick facts.
Al Pacino revealed in Argentina when he performed An Evening with Al Pacino that when they had to rehearse the last scene, De Niro told him no words. And he says he still thinks that was the right call.
Yeah.
It's
he
like
told Pacino not to talk?
Yep.
Because he talks.
Yep.
As he's dying, he says, I told you I was never going back.
Yep. And that was a great line.
Yeah.
Great line. Great ending.
Yeah. Just well, the thing for me, that whole final that final scene was so tense, where they're hiding around the corners.
You don't know who's going to get it.
Right. Well, and it kind of leads you to believe that De Niro's setting this up. He's waiting because that plane's going to come and land, and those lights are going to blind him, and he's going to step out and gun down the cop and win, and the bad guys win. And that almost happens. The plane comes, and he steps out, but at the last second, Pacino sees his shadow.
Yep. Betrayed by his shadow.
Turns and fires, you know. And
yep.
Just an excellent ending.
Yep, got his man. I mean, it's not a happy ending because everybody's marriages are in shambles and all this stuff. But according to IMDb, that gunfight as well, the director asked the actors playing the police to aim deliberately and only fire their rifles in the semi-automatic mode, showing that the police were taking care not to hit bystanders. By contrast, the robbers, concerned only with their own safety, are firing their weapons on full auto, striking several bystanders in the process.
Oh,
that's crazy. So I wanted to talk about this a little bit because I watched this and went, oh my gosh, this reminds me of the North Hollywood shooting.
Right.
Are you familiar with that one?
It was what one?
The North Hollywood shooting.
North Hollywood.
So I thought for some reason that the North Hollywood shooting happened first and they made this movie to kind of echo it.
Yeah.
Nuh-uh. No, North Hollywood shooting was 97. So if you're not familiar with it, a couple of bank robbers in North Hollywood, real ones, armed to the teeth, these guys with fully automatic weapons and body armor. They robbed the North Hollywood branch of the Bank of America.
Oh.
And they were confronted by the LAPD as they left the bank. That's why this was almost like, are they copying this? But, you know, art is stranger than fiction or whatever they call it. Life is stranger than How does that go?
I think it's life is stranger than fiction. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
Because fiction is art.
Yeah. But there's actually video of this. This is something that changed police tactics to this day, is this shootout that happened in 97 with in L.A. And so these guys are what happened basically when the police showed up, these guys just unload on them. Fully automatic weapons, armor piercing rounds, full of body armor. The police fired almost 1,000 rounds at these two guys.
Wow.
And a lot of it was like 9mm, 45, stuff just bouncing off these guys, like for real.
Jeez.
And you can actually watch the ricochets. I mean, they had police helicopters and stuff like this. Ultimately, what ended up happening is I remember watching a documentary on it. One of the cops, they had to borrow like a armored car that somebody had. And ultimately go after higher powered weapons like rifles to take these guys down and find gaps in their armor.
Man,
it was nuts. You can actually go on YouTube and look up the North Hollywood shooting. It's not for the faint of heart. That's my disclaimer. I mean, these people, these guys end up dying, but it was the most insane, like street bank robber shootout you've ever seen in your life. And this was real deal. And it was just like Heat, if not even more intense than the shootout in Heat. And what the result of that was is the police, you know, police forces now, their SWAT tactics changed. They're more prepared. You'll see big tactical vehicles, MRAPs, high powered rifles in every squad car. You know, they need to be able to respond to threats of this level.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge eye opener because most of the cops weren't able to. And there's a bunch of people died from that. It was nuts. So check that out. The North Hollywood shooting, it was wild.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. When you first said the name, right at that very second, this website that had on IMDb there, when I had the cast and crew up, it started playing a video all of a sudden real loud. And I was like, what was that?
What's happening here?
Yeah. So I tried to fake my way through it, pull the curtain back. I was like, and tried to fake my way through it. But then you were asking me a question. And I was like, oh, busted.
Oh, sorry. But yeah, North Hollywood shootout. The North Hollywood shootout itself lasted 44 minutes.
Oof, brutal.
And these guys just marched through a neighborhood, spraying stores and houses and cars. And
crazy.
I think 1,100 armor-piercing bullets.
Wow.
Is what they're estimating they shot. They wounded 11 police officers, 6 bystanders. And it took more than 300 outgunned law enforcement officers from 5 agencies firing back.
Wow.
It's crazy town.
Yeah, that's nuts.
It was just crazy.
Back to the film. I'm fascinated by that. I have to look it up. I've got a note here to pull it up right after we're done, but this movie, a lot of times people are going to look at this and say, okay, you've got two of the biggest names in the mobster police kind of crime thriller, you know, whatever.
Yep.
Pacino versus De Niro, who wins? I mean, I'm not talking characters. I'm talking performance wise. Who won the performance for you? Like came out as like they had the performance. I've got a very clear winner, but I want to hear what you say first.
Who is a better performer?
Who do you think in this
film? I'm going to go Pacino.
Put on the best. See, I'm going to go the opposite. I thought De Niro was much more believable.
I'm thinking about Pacino and his range just from dealing with what he does on a day-to-day basis and trying to keep that separate from his family life while his wife is trying to pry back into it.
Right.
And then she ends up cheating on him and all this stuff. And just his reactions and what he's having to deal with and then finding his daughter and stuff. I think his role was stretched further.
Right. I could see that.
And getting his man at the end of it. I mean, but I don't think he wins by a lot. I mean, they were both fantastic.
To me, I thought both performances were fun, but to me, I really felt like Pacino was in classic parody of himself Pacino mode. Where for no reason he's just shouting and yelling.
Hoo-ah!
Yeah, I mean it's just that crazy, like, and he does it all the time now, you know, since he started doing it. But there's a scene, remember, I can't remember the other character's name, but he goes to visit that guy in like a junkyard or whatever, the snitch. And he's talking to him like, "Where were you? You were supposed to be meeting me, you know." And the guy's like, "Well, you know, I'm busy. I had some stuff. I was out dancing. I was getting some leads for you." And just randomly, he's like, "You got a burger," you know, yelling about stuff and, you know, something about a big rear end and, "Oh, you like a big backside," you know, he was saying different words, but, and then just random stuff where it just out of nowhere, he's just yelling. And then the people he's yelling at are supposed to be playing it as if he's not yelling at them. So they're like, well, I don't know. Like, his wife is a good example when she's getting on him about work. And why don't you let me in, or why don't you tell me anything about it? He's like, I got to keep that angst in here. It's, you know, it's how I keep my edge. It keeps me sharp. So you want me to tell you about work and how I found a baby in there? And he's just yelling, and a guy threw his baby in a microwave and all this stuff. And it's like, but her reaction is just like, I get it. Your work is stressful, but blah, blah, blah. And it's like, she's very even keel, as if he wasn't just lunatic screaming.
Maybe she's used to it.
Face.
I don't know.
Yeah, it was bizarre. And that's for me why De Niro's character, I thought he really had this calm, you know, kind of confident, you know, not really ever shaken up, able to roll with the punches, but also very, like, how did he, I don't, like, precise. You know, he really filled that character where he's the mastermind of all this, and he's very precise. And even when there's twists and turns that come up, he handles it just on the fly. He has the answers. This is what we're going to do, you know. And so I that's why, to me, I gave it to De Niro, just because he didn't do any of the real crazy, over-the-top kind of parody of himself kind of things.
Well, I think they did a great job together.
Yeah, it was a good movie. It was long, and I don't know.
It was very long, but let me ask you. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, let me ask you. At 3 hours long, do you think you would have, like, if it was shorter?
Things.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
This director used a lot of scenery and stuff like that, and an extra few seconds to hold on a scene,
right?
That, you know, could have been cut out.
Yeah,
but it just, to me, it just added to the mood of it. It didn't feel like a 3 hour movie to me.
No, it didn't until I paused it. And it, you know, when I saw that I had that much,
my bladder left, told me it was 3 hours.
Yeah. Well, and it wasn't even that. It's, you know, I was cruising along and I was fully into the story, and I loved how it was so character driven. This movie starts out and it's a post I actually just put up on my AIC pod website the other day about storytelling, in the sense that you don't always have to start at the beginning, you know, because so many people, right, when they're telling stories, they want to go back to the very, very, very beginning, so they don't miss anything. They don't leave anything out. But the point of the article I, you know, was writing there was that, you know, everything starts in the middle of something else. And that's exactly what happened here. You know, this whole movie kicks off and it's middle of other stuff happening. There's unresolved plot points and storylines and characters. You know, a lot of them get tied up, but even Val Kilmer's character, you never know what happens to him.
Right.
His wife saves him and he goes off and who knows where he went.
Yep.
But it doesn't try to wrap the entire universe of everything that could possibly be happening in the world into this one story. It's dropping you in, saying, here's a bloody and, you know, character driven story. And it's done. Those characters saw their arc end and the world goes on. I really enjoyed that approach.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
I'm sitting between 4 and 4.5 stars here. It was good. It was really good. But
as far as
rewatchability, it's so long.
Yeah, that's why, to me, I'm going to give it a 3.5. Yeah,
all right.
I'll give it a 3.5 just because the length of the movie. I don't know if you made it any shorter. I think if you cut stuff out,
if you take a nap in the middle of it. Yeah.
Well, no, I think cutting it shorter, it wouldn't have the same impact. It wouldn't be as good.
Oh, I agree.
But it's just the rewatchability. I remember seeing it when it came out, you know, I was younger, and then hadn't seen it since, but I forgot it was that long. And so it just was one of those, like, yeah, it's good. I definitely recommend people check it out, especially if you like, I don't know, what would you call it? Like a thriller, not really mafia.
Like a Michael Jackson thriller.
Like a heist.
Yeah, yeah.
Heist movie. Yeah.
Yep. It almost seems like a gangster movie.
Almost.
Gangster movie.
Almost. Yeah, but, gangster. Yeah. But no actual gang. Kind of like The Italian Job, but only much darker and bloodier.
Yeah, with a lot less Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah, and no Charlize Theron.
Although Ashley Judd kind of looked Charlize Theron-ish in this movie.
She did a little bit.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for Heat.
Yeah. So
we
next
liked it.
Week,
we dug it.
Yeah. We did. Next week, we've got...
By the power of Grayskull.
Yeah. We are diving into fantastically terrible movie territory. And we're going to have our Patreon supporter Vincent on with us. At least that's a plan as of right now. So we should have four of us here next week. We're going to be reviewing Masters of the Universe with Dolph Lundgren from also the late 80s, early 90s.
Should be just terrible.
Yeah.
All right. It might be time now for the memory. Minute.
Oh, yeah. It's time for Memory Minute.
Absolutely. So we talked about it last week, and this one probably won't go as long because it's kind of a shorter one. But we talked about it last week, you know, kind of what were some of the, you know, first books or one of the first books that you remember reading that just really got you hooked on it, like really were memorable as, yes, I love reading.
Right. And I had an immediate answer in my head, and I've only got one.
Okay.
And most people would probably think, oh, was it Lord of the Rings? No, it's not. The book that got me hooked on, actually, like the first time I ever read a story that was like a full novel was Lost World by Michael Crichton.
Oh.
I was a kid when I read this. It was at the local library. And I think Crichton Lost World. I have to Google this really quick because I don't think it was like a, it's not the sequel like the Lost World. It was the original.
Right.
It was a Jurassic Park. Gosh, which one did I read first? Was Jurassic Park the first novel?
That I don't know.
Oh, Jurassic World. No. Jurassic Park was the first one. I'm sorry, everybody.
Okay.
And it was Jurassic Park. I remember reading Lost World after that one. But it started with Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton. And everybody knows the story of Jurassic Park.
Right.
And I had seen Jurassic Park and I thought, oh, maybe it'd be fun if I read the book. And the book was so good. So much better than the movie, which is something everybody who reads says. Disclaimer, I haven't read a book in ages.
Really?
That's what I feel like. I should, though. I've got a whole stack of them here.
Yeah.
His writing style, the story, I'd never read something that I didn't want to put down in my life before that book.
Right.
That was one where it was like, I'm done eating. Can I go read? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of a deal. And it was fantastic. I should actually go watch it again because as you know, the movies, they condense things down into scenes.
Read it again.
I should watch that movie again. I'll watch a YouTube recap instead. So yeah, mine was Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton. What's yours?
Nice. Well, you know, I was a youngster, I started reading very early. I mean, not like genius level or nothing, but I was into books. So I spent a lot of time reading anything I could. And at a young age, I did read The Hobbit, and then I read the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy. They were great. They're fine. But the one that got me that really hooked me as, like you said, I couldn't put it down and I had to just keep devouring the next book and next book and next book was the Shannara series with Terry Brooks. It was actually his fourth book in that series called The Heritage of Shannara, a part of the Scions of Shannara. Or Scions of Shannara was the book. Heritage of Shannara was that quadrilogy because there was four books in that series. But after I read that and just, you know, flew through it, it's definitely fantasy, but it's not necessarily like knights in shining armor type fantasy. I mean, there's magic, but it's also like just monsters and there's elves and there's other creatures, but it's a very
are there
dark
wizards?
World. Not really.
I'm just kidding.
Kind of. I mean, the closest thing to that is the druid. But the line of druids has died out. There's only one left.
So which exact books were these?
This was the Heritage of Shannara.
And that's the part of the Chronicles?
No, Chronicles of Shannara was the TV show. So the Shannara books, Terry Brooks started writing these in 1977, I think it was. I forget. It's been a long time.
Do you have to watch? Listen to me. Do you have to read like the original series to read the Heritage ones?
No. And there is an order that you can read through them that makes more sense. But the original ones were the Sword of Shannara, the Elf Stones of Shannara, and the Wish Song of Shannara. Okay. That was the first three he wrote through the 70s and 80s. And at that point, when I started reading the next set it's not a trilogy because, like I said, there was four of them. but it was the Heritage of Shannara series, which starts with the Scions of Shannara, then goes to the Druid of Shannara, the Elf Queen, and the Talismans. That set of four books, I think I've reread that, no joke, probably 20 times. And these are big books.
Really?
I mean, epic fantasy. In the Shannara series at this point, there's probably 20-something books. And he's tied so much into all of this stuff. And he's done some things where his original series went and went and went and then almost looped back on itself. And, you know, you got to see the genesis of the world. And you find out how all this stuff started, and it's, you know, kind of this big, evolving, you know, massive epic fantasy. It's an amazing world. The thing about Terry Brooks' writing that I love, though, it's not like Stephen King, where he can get so, you know, Stephen King is so descriptive and so wordy, for lack of another, you know, better term. Terry Brooks is he's very efficient with his writing. He describes things in great detail. He sucks you into his world. He gives you the history and everything you need, but he doesn't spend 5 pages telling you about how the leaves looked on that hillside in that autumn glow. You know what I mean? He's very character plot driven. Yeah.
Ginger's hair.
Exactly. And he's, you know, some of these fantasy awesome. Authors, they can get lost in their descriptors. And
sounds like you like the book.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, this Shannara series.
Maybe I'll have to borrow it from you sometimes. I'm guessing you have it.
Oh, yeah, I've got them. I've got almost, he's got a handful I don't have that I had on Kindle and
Do
stuff.
Do I have any Terry Brooks books on my shelf that you saw?
I don't remember.
I've got that huge stack of books that I got.
I don't remember.
Somebody I never went through.
Yep. No, okay. I can't remember. I know you
I'll
had
take
some...
a look for Terry Brooks' books.
Yeah, he was the first one that really got me. And since then, I mean, I've read a ton of other stuff. But Terry Brooks and in the Scions of Shannara, the Heritage series, just so good. I used to imagine being Walker Bow, the last druid, for for years.
Now, that sounds really nerdy.
Yeah, it does. But
I wish I was the last druid.
He's a total, like... He doesn't want any part of being a hero.
Like, but he is.
Hates it. But he knows he has to.
The reluctant hero.
Exactly. But he's all dark and brooding and like
goth.
Like not a sissy. Like he's going to cut your head off with a
he
sword.
He works at Hot Topic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's very skilled as a fighter too.
Okay.
But then he gets his magic stuff. So yeah, it's a whole thing. But yeah, excellent series of books. Now, Jason did give us, I don't know if he's serious about this. I asked him to tell us what his book was, and he said as a young teen, his favorite books were the Bruno in Boots series by Gordon Corman, and he's super excited because I guess a Google search showed him that this is a series of movies in Canada as well. Now, book one of the Bruno in Boots book series, it says this. In Gordon Corman's beloved first book, Bruno in Boots team up and school is never the same. Bruno
like
and Boots.
Kids books.
Yeah. Bruno and Boots are always in trouble. So the headmaster, aka the fish, decides it would be best to separate them. Bruno must now room with ghoulish Elmer Dimmesdale plus his plants, goldfish, and ants. And Boots is stuck with nerdy, preppy, paranoid George Wexford Smith. I mean, I'm assuming he's being serious because he was quick to answer it and he's excited about the movies, but
alrighty.
I mean apparently there's a skunk involved, but that's what Jason's saying was the first selection for him.
Okay. Well, cool.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, being that Jason's out, as you listeners may or may not know, we are skipping the app recommendations and the geek off for now, but they will be back when we get Jason back. But I think it's time to put the lid on the soup. So head on over to digitalsouppodcast.com. Unless we didn't change our URL, did we?
Like
we
nope. DigitalSoupPodcast.com.
I'm just kidding. Follow us on Twitter at DigitalSoupCast, of course. And remember, you can subscribe and listen to us anywhere that you can subscribe and listen to podcasts. We are everywhere, guys. We're like Facebook listening to you. Just kidding. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher. I mean, we're all over the place. And of course, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review and let us know what you think. And then, of course, we would really appreciate if you would tell a friend about us and say hi to us. So from all of us at the Digital Soup Podcast, all you listeners out there, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and we'll catch you next time.
Take care, guys.
It's the Digital Soup Podcast.